This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Senate wrestles what to do next about a national surveillance program. The Islamic State movement continues to grow.
It functions largely by expanding into new territory, emptying banks, selling off construction equipment, automobiles, trucks, generators, whatever it can.
Snake-like robots come to life. Controversy swirls around a rap song winner. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The White House is criticizing the Senate for failing to reach a deal before legal authority expired for the National Security Agency to bulk collect Americans' telephone data. Spokesman Josh Earnest says a legislative standoff is introducing unnecessary risk for the United States. He says the Senate's failure to act on now-expired Patriot Act provisions that were put in place following the September 11, 2001 terror attacks has had an impact on what national security officials can do to keep the country safe. The Senate could still approve a reformed version of the massive telephone surveillance program in the coming days. VOA Steve Norman spoke about the Senate's action on the surveillance issue with correspondent Michael Bowman.
Steve, the Senate was facing a real conundrum in that it had not acted at all as far as the National Security Agency's ability to collect Americans' telephone records for the fight against terrorism. The House had voted to reform the program and to have all Americans' telephone records kept by telecommunications companies, in other words, under corporate server control rather than the government servers. But the Senate had not acted at all. And without some action by Congress to reform the program, the U.S. government was facing the possibility that no telephone records at all were going to be kept by any entity whatsoever. And the Obama administration had warned that that would cause a real potential problem in terms of defending the nation. So the Senate was really under the gun. Both houses of Congress were in recess this past week. The Senate came back a day early, and moments before the midnight expiration of this program, the Senate voted to begin debate on the House-passed bill. This is a bill that the Senate had rejected just over a week ago, and the Senate's Republican majority leader had held out, hoping that the Senate would vote to extend the NSA's snooping abilities, if you will. But that did not hold, and so now the Senate has voted to at least consider the House bill.
You know, Michael, we've been at this juncture before on a number of issues where the lawmakers just don't know what to do, it seems. Is that another one of those cases where the Senate is just so completely divided that they can't move forward?
It's not that they don't know what to do. It's that there are different factions that have very different ideas about what should be done. For Mitch McConnell, he would have wanted the existing program, the program that the NSA had for years, to continue. There was another faction that wanted it reformed, that wanted those phone records to still be kept, but just not under the government's control. Then you have a third faction that does not think that the bulk collection of telephone records in any capacity is something that should be done in a country that values civil liberties and the privacy of individual Americans. So there was this gridlock in Congress, and specifically in the Senate. The House had voted overwhelmingly on a bipartisan basis to embrace the reform proposal, what's called the USA Freedom Act. But it was really in the Senate, which has been called the world's greatest deliberative body, where things were falling apart. Now it seems that the two houses of Congress, both under Republican control, are at least on the same page. So some might say that that at least constitutes some form of progress.
Well, whatever happens with the USA Freedom Act, it likely will not come easy, will it?
Well, it could come easy if the Senate goes ahead and votes within the next day or two. Then the House bill will have been passed, and it will go to President Obama's desk for his signature. I should say that it's not entirely clear how this will play out from a national security perspective. If you have these telephone records kept by private telecommunications companies, will that make it more difficult for the federal government to monitor things and to keep on top of possible terrorist plots? Could there be possible security breaches if these phone records are kept by telecommunications companies? The way forward is a bit murky, and how this will play out from a national security perspective and from a civil liberties perspective remains to be seen.
Correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with VOA's Steve Norman. The telephone data collection from millions of calls was first revealed 2 years ago by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, now living in asylum in Russia. It included phone numbers, the dates and duration of calls, but not the content. The surveillance issue is playing big on social media. Reporter Michael Levin joins us now with a look at how people are reacting online to the expiration of the NSA program. Michael?
Hi, Ray. We've had a couple of comments posted on our latest NSA web article, which is by our Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, and it's headlined, "With Data Collection Halted, U.S. Senate Debates Surveillance Reform." Thos Hart from here in the U.S. downplayed the impact of the NSA losing its ability to collect phone data, writing, "Unlimited phone surveillance expired, yet the sun has come up. No apocalypse." Another reader who goes by the name Solaris praised Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who leaked the documents that revealed the spy agency's phone data collection program in 2013. Solaris said, "There is no doubt that Edward Snowden is the hero of our time. The difference between this whistleblower and others is that he is defending human rights while not supporting any form of anarchy." Snowden, who's living in exile in Russia, also has plenty of U.S. critics who point out that he's still wanted here on criminal charges, including passing classified information to unauthorized parties. We'll have also been looking at how the NSA issue has been resonating on Twitter. Analytics website Topsy shows that the NSA has been a popular topic, being mentioned in more than 53,000 tweets in the past day. That's the highest level of tweets since May 7th, when a U.S. court ruled that the NSA's collection of bulk telephone data was illegal. Among the latest tweets that I saw was one from a columnist for The Guardian newspaper who drew attention to his new NSA piece. Trevor Tim noted that Monday was the first day since 2001 that you can make a call in the U.S. and the data won't be automatically sucked up by the NSA, as he put it. Texas radio show host Alex Jones had some fun with the issue. Here's what he posted. "If I tweet this tweet and the NSA is not there to collect it, does it make a noise?" Back to you, Ray.
Thanks, Michael. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lipin. That's spelled L-I-P-I-N. Many anti-terrorism experts contend that modern terrorism is evolving at such speed that counterterrorism strategies are falling behind. But others note that the newly morphed terrorists can be their own worst enemies. VOA's Yella De Franceschi looks at both sides of the issue.
After the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the United States, counterterrorism was focused on preventing another such spectacular assault. But 14 years later, the new spectacular was the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, which was low-scale and low-tech, but made a huge impact. A major world capital was shut down by a few armed people with firearms and homemade bombs. The attackers were two Islamist brothers who grew up in France. They were not trained and radicalized in an Al-Qaeda camp. It happened online. David Kilcullen is a leading international anti-terrorism expert. He spoke via Skype.
As little as 5 years ago, it was still a topic of debate in the intelligence community as to whether it was actually possible to recruit and then operationalize somebody purely online. This is part of a much more sophisticated strategy that uses social media and the internet and communications tools, and it now has access to military-grade weaponry because of the war in Syria and Iraq.
The returning foreign fighter is a new normal, too. The CIA estimates about 20,000 foreign volunteers have joined jihadist groups. Some 3,000 come from Europe. The flow continues as the RAND Corporation's top counterterrorism expert, Brian Jenkins, also via Skype.
The Prime Minister of France said that there would be up to 10,000 European volunteers in Syria and Iraq by the end of 2015. Some will acquire experience, skills, and contacts, which will make them much more formidable adversaries if they choose to continue the jihad at home.
The conflict-ridden Middle East and other regions have created failed states, while groups such as the self-styled Islamic State are seizing territories and trying to govern. But Jenkins says the trend is doomed to failure because of their plunder-based economy.
It functions largely by expanding into new territory, emptying banks, selling off construction equipment, automobiles, trucks, generators, whatever it can. You have to keep on expanding to feed that economy, or it begins to implode.
An even greater challenge to keeping a jihadist state is the ferocity of its proponents, says Philip Mudd, a former high-ranking CIA and FBI official.
When I get the question of how do you think we're doing in this war, my answer is always, who was winning the war of ideas? People have decided across the Islamic world that what we've seen in the past 15 years is the murder of innocents, and that's never acceptable.
Polls show that in most Muslim countries, large majorities reject violence against civilians. The prevailing view, says Mudd, is that such acts are never justified as a means of defending Islam from its enemies. Yela De Franceschi for VOA News in Washington.
Another health alarm in Asia. Details coming up. This is VOA's International Edition.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. It's hot in India, very hot. A severe heat wave is turning into the second deadliest the country's ever had and the fifth deadliest in the history of the world. More than 2,000 people have died so far. Anjana Pasricha has details.
Scattered rain brought relief to a handful of places from scorching temperatures that have persisted for nearly 2 weeks across much of India. But across vast swaths of the country, the heat showed no signs of letting up. A Brussels-based disaster center, the Emergency Events Database, called it the world's fifth deadliest heat wave. The deputy director of the New Delhi-based Center for Science and Environment, Chandra Bhushan, says although India is used to coping with high temperatures, the summer heat has turned deadlier as temperatures increase more rapidly.
Generally, in the Indian subcontinent, there is a slow ramp up of temperature that happens. Okay, but that didn't happen. We had an unusually wet and cold March and April, and then from the first week of May, the temperature suddenly started to increase, and the ramp up was very, very fast. Now, what it means is that in a very short period of time, temperature increased by close to 15 to 20 degrees.
In the worst affected states, such as Andhra Pradesh, authorities issued advisories for people to stay in the shade. But it was advised many poor people, such as construction labor, hawkers, and vendors, dependent on daily wages, could not afford to heed. The plight of those in crowded cities was worsened as a lack of tree cover and paved surfaces drove temperatures higher. In many places, temperatures have hovered around 45 degrees Celsius. Experts point out that although heat waves are now listed as a disaster, little has been done to cope with them on the same war footing as cyclones and earthquakes. But as the killer heat wave persists across large parts of the country, calls for authorities to do more to prepare for such extreme weather are becoming louder. For the time being, all hopes are pinned on the annual monsoon rains, which usually hit the southern coast by this time, and which weather officials say could arrive any day. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
Here now are the hour's headlines. China says a passenger ship traveling the Yangtze River with more than 450 people aboard sank late Monday in the Hubei region of central China. Xinhua says only 20 have been rescued as of early Tuesday. One body has been recovered. Nigeria's newly inaugurated President Muhammadu Buhari is to visit Chad and Niger this week. A sign that the country is helping fight Boko Haram Islamist insurgency is a top priority for the man who was sworn in just last Friday. The Sunni extremist group is suspected of having attacked the northeast Borno state capital of Maiduguri over the weekend, killing nearly 30 people. The United Nations says South Sudan has decided to expel UN aid coordinator Toby Lanzer, a move condemned by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who called for a reversal of the decision. In Nairobi Monday, Kenya's president called on South Sudan leaders to end more than a year of conflict. That's the latest news from VOA. The South Korean Health Ministry says two people have died from Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. A 58-year-old woman and a 71-year-old man succumbed Monday. The health ministry also reports six new cases of the viral disease, bringing the total infections to 25. MERS is a respiratory illness that initially produces flu-like symptoms. There is no vaccine for treatment, and the fatality rate is over 40%. VOA's Brian Patton has more.
The South Korean outbreak is the largest among countries outside the Middle East. As a precautionary measure, the South Korean Ministry of Health and Welfare said it has put under quarantine or special observation over 680 people who were exposed directly or indirectly to the MERS virus, which affects the respiratory system, causing flu-like symptoms. Hong Kong has also quarantined 18 people and isolated 17 more. And in China's Guangdong province, where there is one confirmed case of MERS, nearly 80 people have been isolated. Kwang Jun-uk, the director of public health policy at South Korea's Ministry of Health and Welfare, is leading a national MERS management team. So far, he says there have been no fatalities.
환자 상태 분류에 따라서는 지금
He says there are currently five patients in unstable condition and one is very unstable. Authorities say this outbreak of MERS began in Korea with patient number one, a 68-year-old Korean man who was diagnosed with MERS in May after returning to Seoul from a trip to Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Authorities have not released his name. All of the subsequent cases reported so far, according to South Korea's health ministry, were the result of secondary exposure, meaning exposure to the disease came through direct contact with patient number one. South Korea has come under some criticism for its handling of the outbreak in the early stages. Patient number one went to four hospitals before he was properly diagnosed with MERS. Kim Woo-joo, a professor of infectious diseases at Korea University, is now working with South Korea's Ministry of Health to contain the MERS outbreak. Professor Kim says at least 10 of the infected Koreans came in contact with patient one at the second hospital where he was treated. Kim says most of those exposed were in the same room or same floor as patient one, so they need to conduct a chronological investigation and analyze the infection management situation. He also said two doctors who were exposed were not wearing proper protective clothing. Also, South Korea did not make the quarantine restrictions mandatory, and some people exposed to MERS reportedly refused to remain in voluntary isolation. The 44-year-old South Korean businessman who was diagnosed with MERS in Guangdong was reportedly exposed to patient one in Seoul. He then began to feel ill, and despite advice from his doctor to stay home, he traveled to China through Hong Kong. The quarantines in Hong Kong and China are in response to possible exposure to the MERS patient in Guangdong. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
This is VOA's International Edition. Modular robots are getting closer to reality. VOA Susan Yaki spoke with correspondent George Putich about what it means for those of us who are human.
A robot being developed at Carnegie Mellon University has evolved into something of a multi-legged, modular, mechanical snake. It will slither over rugged surfaces and explore its surroundings. Sounds a little scary. VOA's George Putich has been following the story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, George.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you. Well, tell us about this thing.
Well, I have to go back a little bit. Scientists at Carnegie Mellon University have been experimenting with the snake-like robots for a while. It started when they noticed that the sidewinder rattlesnake
that lives in Texas
has a very peculiar way and very efficient way of moving over sand. And they studied the snakes at the Atlanta Zoo.
It kind of goes sideways and lifts its body up in the air as it moves.
Correct. And they tried to emulate it with machine. So after a lot of experimenting, they finally designed a machine that can move like a rattlesnake. And you can only imagine how useful such a machine could be, exploring crevices, moving under rubble, you know, search and rescue operations, maybe nuclear power plants. And it's still in development, but it looks great. And maybe I should try to explain how it looks.
Yes,
if you imagine your wrist, right, is very movable, right? And imagine if you could attach several wrists
together.
to each other and control them with a remote control, such a device could be very, very useful, right? So this is how the snake moves. And now the next stage of development, they realized that if they take six short snakes and attach them to a box and create sort of an insect, right?
Mm-hmm.
That could also be useful because all of those legs are very movable. They are independent of each other, but can be controlled. So, you know, the experimenting is going on, and it's just, you know, where your imagination leads you.
Yes. I presume this would have a camera on it or several cameras?
Yes. The head of the snake, as they call it, has a camera and lights, of course.
It must be very sturdy if it's going to do
all this.
It's
very sturdy. It can be thrown about and it can easily recover. It does not have sort of up or down, you know, mm-hmm. The snake can be turned any way and can be still moving. The only downside of this robot is that it has to trail a cable with controls and, of course, power.
Well, maybe one day they'll get over that hurdle, too, and be able to have it without it.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned it might be used for going to disaster sites. Could you tell us a little bit more about how they could use it?
Yes. Actually, they tested their snake robot in an abandoned, never-used nuclear plant in Austria.
Oh.
And the snake went into it's very good going over obstacles and around corners. So the snake went full 18 meters, which is a lot, you know, into some pipes that were all twisted, and it came out fine. And when it was inside, it sent excellent video of the surroundings. So, you know, it's obvious that it can be very useful sometimes.
Well, it's really, really interesting.
It is.
Well, thank you for coming.
You're welcome. Anytime.
That's reporter George Putich right here in our Washington studios.
An award-winning rap song is getting rapped by listeners. Some fans don't think Australian-born Iggy Azalea's song called Fancy should have won the Billboard Award for Best Rap Song. Here's VOA's David Byrd.
First of First things first, I'm the realest.
Realest.
Drop this and let the whole world feel it.
Let them feel it.
And I'm still
Iggy Azalea's pop rap tune, Fancy, has gathered all kinds of awards. It's made her all kinds of money. But it's also gotten her in a little bit of controversy. There was a petition to have her Billboard award revoked. To find out why and to talk more about this, I'm joined by Shauna Renee. Shauna, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This controversy, first of all, Iggy Azalea is an Australian who has emigrated to the United States.
Correct.
She had a very, very popular hit. Every time you turned on pop radio, you heard Fancy.
Mm-hmm.
She was given the Billboard Award this year, for that song. But apparently there was some controversy and there was actually a petition to revoke her award.
Yes. Well, she received the 2015 Billboard Music Award for Top Rap Song. And a group of fans, Nicki Minaj fans, signed or created a petition on change.org. And they argue that the song was released a month before the eligibility date. So in order for a song to be eligible for an award, the production company or whoever's hosting the award will say, well, from this date to this date, the song must have been released. Well, as it turns out, the song was released in enough time. It just hadn't hit the top 100 here in the United States in enough time. So technically, she was still eligible for the award. But there were over 20,000 signatures, people who thought that Nicki Minaj's Anaconda should have won the award.
Now, is this just sour grapes? Or, you know, Billboard basically said, look, it's our award and we'll give it to who we want to, right?
Well, and exactly. And they said, more importantly, it followed the rules. It was released within the time that it should have been. But you cannot ignore the fact that any time Iggy Azalea comes up in the hip-hop or rap community, that there are some cultural and racial undertones. So sour grapes, perhaps, on the part of Nicki Minaj fans who thought that Nicki specifically should have received the award. But there's been a lot of talk about whether or not Iggy Azalea is authentically hip-hop or authentically rap, whether or not she deserves a rap award versus, let's say, a pop award.
This is kind of a controversy that's been brewing for a while, though, because there's been a lot of pop rap songs, but they're not necessarily hip-hop songs, right?
Well, yeah, and it's kind of interesting and difficult to determine what is what. But there's been a lot of discussion, not only about the way a song sounds, but who's actually producing it. We saw this very same controversy sort of rear its head around the Grammys a couple of years ago when Macklemore and Ryan ended up winning a ton of hip-hop or rap awards. And there were questions about whether or not they are actually rap. They represent the genre. And you have to remember, here in the States, when you talk about rap, it's not just the music, it's the culture that goes along with it. And that's where people are a little unsure.
All right, that's Shauna Renee. And if you would like to learn more about this, log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. You can also catch Shauna in the Soul Lounge. She's on that same website, voanews.com. Shauna, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And this final political note, U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a hawkish advocate for U.S. military intervention in overseas conflicts, joined the crowded field Monday seeking the party's 2016 presidential nomination. He became the 9th Republican to announce his candidacy and the 4th Republican senator. And that'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information and look at pictures anytime on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.